Simply Authentic is the podcast where realtors and referral partners get the conversations they actually want to hear. I'm Crystal Forbes with Great American Title, a family-owned and operated title company with over 30 years serving the real estate community. We provide title and escrow services for both Missouri and Kansas with locations throughout Southwest Missouri. We focus on providing exceptional customer service and trustworthy, reliable title insurance coverage. Our relationships with other industry professionals are why we are able to make dreams come true one closing at a time. Great American Title is proud to sponsor the Simply Authentic podcast, bringing the most relevant, real, and sometimes challenging conversations that help all of us get better. Tune in, subscribe, and let's keep this industry moving forward together. Simply Authentic, recorded at the Gershman Mortgage Studios, available wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to the Simply Authentic podcast with Angie and Tanya. We are real estate pros, entrepreneurs, leadership gurus, and community enthusiasts. Our passion is sharing our experiences to enrich the lives of others. We hope to inspire you to live authentically. Back to the Simply Authentic podcast. I'm Tanya Murfin.
And I'm Angie Mullings. And we're very excited today. We have a guest joining us. She is Allison Forgale. Allison is a professor, a speaker, and she is the author of Likeable Badass. So welcome and thanks for joining us, Allison.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we got to hear you, had the pleasure of hearing you at Ladies Who Launch here in Springfield a couple of months ago, I guess now, and loved what you had to say. Both bought the book and we've been reading it and looking it over and digesting all the things. But why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and what led you to write the book?
Sure. So I am now a professor of organizational psychology. I've done that for over 20 years. I teach at the University of North Carolina. And in a lot of that work for years, I have taught topics that relate to human behavior or behavioral science that help people work better. And in particular, I have taught negotiation and influence for a very long time. And it was that work that eventually led me to specifically serving women and working with women. In that, most of the time, when I'm in audiences and rooms, the rooms will have more men in them than women, more male MBA students, more men leaders in organizations. But I noticed that despite the fact that the women were numerically fewer, they were often the ones who were coming to me after a class, a program, a talk with questions. And I understood when they would come to me, they were coming for two reasons. One was I looked like them, so I seemed like a safe person to ask their question to. And that they were having challenges, particularly negotiating and influencing, that their male colleagues maybe weren't having, that they weren't able to get people to say yes to them or get what they wanted, or they were fearful of things. And so as I started having those one-on-one conversations, I realized how much science there was from my field of psychology that could be helpful, empowering to women as they navigated a lot of challenges that were not their fault, and to feel more effective and more confident. And that was the beginning of my work with women that I eventually evolved in a series of steps to first, I would do conferences for women, like where we met. And I would do programming for women. And then the book was a natural outgrowth of that. As I started to do more, I wanted to be able to offer more advice than I would ever be able to do live because no one's going to listen to me for that long. And I also wanted to reach people that I might never otherwise reach because, you know, not everyone gets to go to Ladies Who Launch, right? That's a privilege to be able to have something of that caliber that you can attend. And so how could we disseminate this information more broadly so it was accessible to all women? So that was eventually how I came to do it, but it took a while. I mean, I've been a professor for over 20 years. I just wrote this book a year ago. So it's been not a master life plan, but just an evolution of getting to work with women.
And how great the opportunity that someone can pick up your book or be referred to your book. And it really has so many valuable lessons. I can't imagine there would be a woman in the workplace that couldn't resonate with a chapter or chapters in your book. So I personally have really enjoyed reading it and partaking in some of your wisdom that you're giving us women.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's been a really beautiful process to write it and through it to be in situations like this, where it's a way that people get to know me who didn't know me personally, and they find me through the book, and I'm able to hopefully be helpful, but also then to develop, you know, relationships with them when they reach out and ask questions or talk about how, what they've learned from it.
Yeah. Yeah. The basic premise I'm going to say is you really delve into status versus power. And can you talk to us about why we get that wrong often?
Yeah. So this is the crux of the book. Well, I'll define them both. Okay. Power. We use that term a lot. Power, what it is definitionally is you control resources that people value. So it work, for example, if you control the budget, the money, you have a valuable resource. If you get to make the decisions by saying, you know, I can do this without anyone's approval, that's a resource. If you could hire someone or fire someone, that's a resource. So these are forms of power. I have three kids. My oldest is a teenager. If I hold the car keys, I'm holding a resource. And power is important. The reason people want power is because it makes you influential. If I have the car keys, my son is much more likely to do what I want him to do. Why? Because he wants the resource. If at work, we get to control the money and the rewards, people are going to do what we want them to do. So power is something we seek because it's such an important component of our ability to be influential. And we all, you know, want to be influential. So it's really important. And for women, the two most commonly discussed forms of power are going to be pay, that we are often paid less for the same work, and representation, that we are not promoted to the same levels despite the same qualifications. So that's all really important. We need to solve it, and it makes sense that we care about it. Good. But there's a second thing that is equally important, but much less understood, which is why I wrote the book. And that's this notion of status. So if power is controlling resources, status is being respected by other people. And this is also a source of influence. If your audience doesn't respect you, you will not get them to do anything, which explains why it's very hard to influence your teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need respect to be influential. And you also need that respect to be able to get the power. Because in many of our life contexts, right, we only get to be in charge because someone said it was okay. So no one's going to put you in charge if they don't respect you and value you. Mm-hmm. So that's this piece of the status piece. And it's a lot harder for people to understand. We haven't talked about it as much. So a lot of times people, they know what it means to be respected, but they don't really know how to influence it. And for a lot of women, you know what it feels like to be disrespected or undervalued despite doing amazing work. So that's really the idea. And when you say get it wrong, both are important. But because people don't understand status and they do understand power, I typically find people tend to jump to trying to get more power without really understanding the psychology of status and how important it is for people to be able to give you that power in the first place. So it's not to abandon our concerns for power. It matters. But to put an equal level of concern on status as well, we can influence it more than we think, which is one of the ideas I try to convey in the book. And when we do, we reap a lot of rewards, and that can be really helpful, you know, for living a happy life and getting all of the success that we absolutely deserve.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Allison, if it's okay with you, I'm going to read an excerpt from the book. Mm-hmm. And I really, really resonated with this in chapter 7, because you kind of wrap it up, if you will. Use your status and your airline miles for your own long-term benefit and for the benefit of others. As Amy Schulman points out, women underestimate the role that we can play in the success of other people. She advises us to be unafraid to introduce people, compliment somebody when it's deserved, and stand up for something you really believe in.
being a fighter for the people on your team when appropriate, and arguing for principles that matter. Don't sell yourself short. When you've earned respect and admiration, you're in a privileged position to do a lot of good, both for yourself and for others. I really love that. Mm-hmm. And it really, when I was reading chapter 7, and I love the exercises in that. We've had a program recently that we use those exercises. This paragraph really summarizes how we should feel about our status.
Yeah, the idea that status is a resource, just like money is a resource. Money that you hide under your mattress doesn't do much for your quality of life, right? It only is good when you use it. And status is the same way. You have to invest in it to have people respect you. But when they do, then we also don't want to be afraid to use it. And the airline miles reference is a quote by this woman, Amy Schulman, who is a lawyer. And she had a couple of roles. But when she was the general counsel of Pfizer pharmaceutical company, she was interviewed. And she made this reference that women tend to hoard their status the way people hoard airline miles. You earn all those miles from travel, and then you don't want to spend them because you just think, I'm going to need those someday for the trip of a lifetime. And then you're buying all these plane tickets, not spending your miles, and then there is no trip of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that women often do the same thing. Once we work so hard to be valued in our relationships, but then we are worried, if I take a stand on something, you might value me less now. You might be angry at me. You might, if I take a risk, and I don't want that because I've worked so hard. So I end up being silenced. I save my status as if it were airline miles. And one of the points I want to, that I make is that it's just like money. The balance can increase and it can decrease, but you have moments to build it back. And so we don't have to be afraid of using that resource for things that really matter. Now, we don't want to spend frivolously. I see people ruin their reputations over dumb things. Mm-hmm. And I think, what a waste. You worked so hard to get to that point. Don't throw it away. So you do want to be thoughtful about it. But to be afraid to use your status is going to also limit us. Both are important, getting the status and using it for to live the life you want to live. Just a resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Allison, we interview a lot of female CEOs in our community, and it's interesting. We hear the same thing over and over again. So I'm curious what your research has shown with regard to, like, just recently we interviewed a CEO. And she said, I didn't know what a CEO looked like. How was I supposed to do that job? Because everyone before me was a man. And she was the first woman in her position. And she didn't know what a female CEO should look like. And then we interviewed another CEO recently who said, we used to go around the room and I would introduce myself and I wouldn't include my title or the status that I had gained. I felt comfortable just simply saying my name and not adding anything. What has your research shown in that? Because I think that's typical, right? We both can appreciate that and have been in similar situations. So what is it about us that makes us want to play it small in general?
Yeah, and this is it's a human tendency, right? Mm-hmm. So there's two dimensions that form our status. And this is where the title of the book, Likeable Badass, what is it? It refers to these two dimensions. The first dimension is we earn status when other people think we care about them or we care about people other than ourselves because we respect someone whose intentions are to be helpful and to deliver good, right? So if I think you want to help me out, I'm going to value you. But I also value your abilities to help me. So it's nice that your heart is in the right place, but can I rely on you? Can I trust you? Are you competent? Are you capable? And so those two dimensions, which in psychology we talk about as being warm and being assertive, on the cover and in the book, I talk about them as being likable and badass. They're just terms for these things. Like, you need to be other-oriented and you need to be results-oriented. Mm-hmm. So there's a human tendency to care about being likable and being warm and to know that we're judged on that. And what people do, which is a mistake, is when I want to be well-liked, the typical way I do that is by being less competent and capable. So I might minimize, I wouldn't talk about my qualifications, for example. Why am I doing that? Because I want you to like me. I don't want to seem boastful or braggy. And so there's a logic there. But, and the same thing is when I want to seem really capable, what people often do is they get less nice. So sometimes if the CEO comes in and says, I need to be in charge, they might start to be less friendly and warm because they think this is how you show people how smart you are. Same thing if someone's in an interview. People often get really stiff in interviews. Why? Because they know it's a situation where they're evaluated on how capable they are. And they don't know if they show up as nice and friendly, does that diminish their capability? And the answer is no. These are two separate dimensions. And we have to recognize that it is important. You shouldn't come across as boastful, braggy, you know, conceited. That won't do well for you. But the way to do it isn't by hiding everything that you've accomplished. You have to think about doing both, talking about your accomplishments, but also talking about how you care about other people. So what I've had this same experience where people will often ask me, should we call you doctor? Which technically I am because I have a PhD, but to me it feels weird. Like someone's going to ask me for medical advice, which I cannot give. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't really like doctor or even professor. Just call me Allison. And I would have this very casual style, which is warm and friendly. But I often noticed as I went throughout my career, when I was younger, my job was to give people advice who were older than I was, who had jobs that I had not held, and recognizing that that capability piece also really mattered. People weren't going to listen to me or be influenced by me unless they thought I had something of value to offer. And my credentials aren't the only way to say that, but it often is a very quick way to say it. Right? When I come in and I say, hi, I'm an organizational psychologist. I've been a business school professor for 20 years. I have my PhD from Stanford. People learn a lot about like high level credentials in a short period of time. I had to coach myself to get more comfortable talking about myself in that way that just felt very unappealing, because I recognized that if I didn't tell somebody what I could do, how would they ever learn it in a short interaction with me when I walk into the room? There's no other way for them to know this. So that's very common. And what I would say is, like, when you hide your capabilities, that doesn't make you seem more nice. It just makes you seem less capable. And when you pull back from being nice, it doesn't make you seem smarter. It just makes you seem less nice. So the key is, I always say to people, think about how to be both. So yeah, you have credentials and you have knowledge and you should let that shine. And then also you should think about, it's equally important for me to convey that I really care about other people, right? That I care about not just being, you know, I'm not just here to boast, I'm here to deliver value. And leaning into both of those things is going to feel much more authentic and it's going to be a lot more effective for people. Mm-hmm. So what I would say to like the people who are afraid to introduce themselves or talk about their credentials is do it, but then think about what are the other things you're putting in there that signal to people, you really matter to me. So asking questions of people and getting really curious about them and praising them and complimenting them, mm-hmm. though, while we are at the same time talking about our skills, that package is a lot more compelling to be able to do both than simply like, I'm just not going to tell you anything about me. It doesn't hit on either dimension.
Well, and that also will speak to your reputation. So we have to earn our reputation over time, right? Doesn't matter what our title is, what position we hold. If we're just in general an ass and we don't treat people with kindness, then you might still continue to be able to say you're the CEO, but your actions will speak louder than words. And that takes time for people to kind of curate that.
It does. We build our status over time, but we also can do a good job of it even in a short interaction. Mm-hmm. You meet a stranger for coffee and, you know, you're going to have 30 minutes to tell a lot about yourself in that interaction and to ask about them. And even in those 30 minutes, you've had those 30 minutes where you walk away from someone you just met and you're like, I love them. I am definitely going to keep that person in my life. Like, I'm going to hang out with them. And you've had the other ones where after 30 minutes, you'd say, that was the longest 30 minutes I've ever spent. I can deal without ever seeing that person again. So it does happen over time, but we can also do a good job in these short moments. And we don't want to throw those away to say, how in a short interaction can I stand out to you that I'm a person of value who has a lot of skills and I'm willing to use them to help you. And we've had that feeling and we can be that person for other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Allison, will you talk a little bit about imposter syndrome? Because that's another thing that when we have CEOs, high level professional women on our show, we often hear, you know, I feel like an imposter. And I love what you had to say in the book about imposter syndrome. So would you share that?
Absolutely. So I'll give you an analogy that's not in the book because it didn't occur to me till afterward. So I exercise as much as I can. You know, I just turned 50. I'm like, okay, you know, I got to do the things and lift the weights and do the running and everything. Mm-hmm. And often, sometimes after I exercise, I feel sore. Right? I wake up and, you know, an arm hurts or muscles that you didn't know you had, right? Mm-hmm. And that's happened to everybody at some point. Now, when you feel sore, it's not really fun to feel sore, right? You like get up and your legs hurt, but you don't also like panic about it or go to the emergency room. In fact, there's a part of you that's a little bit proud because you recognize, why am I sore? Because I really exercised pretty hard yesterday. That's doing a good thing. And although I don't like the soreness, I'm not going to quit exercising just because I feel sore, because it's doing a great thing for me. So imposter syndrome is the analogy to sore muscles, which is it's a byproduct of doing something really good. And it's not something that we ever should try to make fully go away. What's the good thing? The good thing is having ambitious goals. When we set ambitious goals, what we know from decades of psychology is we do better. Even if you don't fully achieve the goal, the fact that you've put the goal all the way up here is going to propel you to achieve more. So we want to be setting goals for ourselves. However, where does imposter syndrome live? It lives between who we are right now and the goals that we've set. We in our own heads are looking ahead, right, to all that we could be in the future. And I always say that wherever you are today, you would have probably killed to be here 10 years ago. But now you're here and it's not interesting anymore. You're like, I did that. Now I'm like, what am I doing next? So we always have a next, which is wonderful. We always should have another goal in the future. It's going to drive us to deliver more, have bigger impact, more success. But because you're always looking at where you're going versus where you are, you're like, I feel like I'm not there yet, right? And that's creating that feeling of being an imposter, just like the sore muscles, meaning you can be doing all the right things and then you have this bad feeling afterward. And what I tell people is that I give lots of examples in the book of uber famous people who have gone on record and done interviews about how much imposter syndrome they feel. And I always say, if those people feel it, like we're all going to feel it. It's clearly not going away. So what I talk about is how can you learn to tell yourself a different story the same way you tell yourself a story when your muscles are sore. When you're sore, the next thing is like, oh, it doesn't feel good, but I know I had a good workout yesterday, so I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And when you feel impostery, a lot of times people will have this story which makes it feel worse. They'll think, oh my God, I definitely feel like I'm a fraud. I must be a fraud. No one else feels this way. If I weren't a fraud, I wouldn't feel this way. It feels so terrible. And it's that whole story that feels really bad. And what I encourage people to practice is when they have those feelings of imposter feelings, is to say, this is natural. This is what happens when you're reaching and growing. This is not a bad thing, even though it doesn't feel very comfortable. This means I'm stretching, I'm growing. It's going to propel my success. And hopefully that narrative in your head allows you to like live with it with a little more peace and say, I'm doing a good thing.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. And, you know, I would say that when Tanya and I started this podcast, we probably both felt a little bit of imposter syndrome because
very much.
We know what to do in our real estate world. We're both brokers and realtors and we're not an imposter in that world, but then we started something new. And while we had a lot to give and a lot of advice to share and people we knew, it still felt a little imposterous that who are we to think that we can go on and do a podcast, you know, when Yeah. What do we have that someone else doesn't have?
Right.
That's right. And but then as you get more experience and this starts to feel more comfortable, you then pick something else. You're like, I'm going to make my podcast bigger. I'm going to expand the reach. I'm going to go do another venture. We're never satisfied. And that's beautiful because achieving in life is one of the things that makes life good to live. Like life's worth living. So we always want to have that. And the most successful people will have it, which means the most successful people are going to have those impostery feelings because they're always stretching to try to do something new. And so getting comfortable being uncomfortable, that's something like those fitness people tell you while you're gasping for breath.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with imposter. Yeah. You got to get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Angie, I think it's a good time for a break.
I think so. We'll be right back.
Real talk, real industry insights. Simply Authentic is the podcast where realtors and referral partners get the conversations they actually want to hear. I'm Jack Langley at Gershman Mortgage. We've been helping home buyers and real estate professionals for over 70 years, and we know that success just isn't about transactions. It's about knowledge, relationships, and having the right tools to grow. That's why we're proud to host Simply Authentic in our studio, bringing you the most relevant, real, and sometimes challenging conversations that help us all get better. Tune in, subscribe, and let's keep this industry moving forward together. Simply Authentic, recorded at the Gershman Mortgage Studios, available wherever you get your podcast.
And we're back with Allison Forgale, and she is the author of Likeable Badass. And we're having a great conversation. We talked about imposter syndrome. We've talked about status versus power. And, Allison, another thing I love about the book is that you try to give examples to fit different personalities. You give the example of connecting with someone and you have a friend who smiles all the time. And you said, that's not really me, but I can tell a joke and I can connect with people that way. So I love that you give different examples because whatever we do, we want it to be authentic to who we are. And so we shouldn't push to connect with people the same way that our friends do or people we admire do.
And in fact, it's in the title of your show, right? This idea, yeah. I am such a huge proponent of blending authenticity with strategy and intention, right? Mm-hmm. Authenticity does not mean you do whatever you want without regard for anybody else and how you make people feel. That's not an authentic that we're really going for that will make us proud, and it certainly won't serve us well. But then the other version of, I have to only do things a certain way, the way I've been told, and that doesn't feel like me, that's not a good life either. It's a recipe for burnout, for resentment. So the idea of how do we bring authenticity and strategy together in the context of something like building our status, building respect, is we have to recognize that human beings are judging, basing respect on these two big dimensions, right? Do I care and am I capable? And then what I have to recognize is it's my role to show up in ways that will send good signals to my audience that I do really care and I am really capable. Where I have a lot of freedom is what specific signals do I want to send? So I do talk in the book about nonverbal behaviors are often what cues that human beings use to figure out, like, what are someone's intentions? If someone's smiling, your brain thinks that person's happy. They like me, whatever. Right. If someone's scowling, you think something's wrong. That's natural. So that means that a nonverbal expression is a communication act. And if I like you, I want you to know that I like you. And I don't want you to think I'm mad because I have a scowl on my face. So as I learned in my own life that I wasn't a very good smiler, and it led people to think I was unhappy with them when I wasn't, I tried for a short period of time, maybe even a long period of time, to be a better smiler. And I found that it didn't really work. My face hurt. I would forget half the time. It just felt like a lot of work. And I'm like, you know what? I just have to recognize that some people just don't have the best nonverbal behaviors. But that doesn't mean I just give up and I scowl at people. I think, okay, well, how do I like to show people I care? I'm good with words. I'm really good at complimenting people, lifting people up, praising people. I like humor. I can make people feel at ease and create that kind of camaraderie through humor. So I have my ways, but my ways might be different than other people I know. And when we find our ways, that's how we can blend authenticity and strategy. I like telling jokes, so I tell jokes. That's authentic. But it's also strategic because when it's creating a warm and fun atmosphere, I know that it's making people feel comfortable with me and like me and enjoy me. So that is absolutely a key part of what I try to offer all the time in the book and otherwise, is you got to find your way. And it could be different than someone next to you. But a lot of times the way we find our way is by observing people who are kind of like us or who are like we want to be. So if you have someone in your life, whether you work with them or they're in your personal life, and you think that person really does embody likable badass to me. Like people really respect them. They're seen as really giving and really knowledgeable. And I admire them. But I also think they're kind of like me. Like we are similar in some ways. Those are great people to seek out and have conversations with and say, how do you think about these things? Why do you do what you do? And they may not know at first, because some of it might be so habitual to them that they're not exactly sure what they're doing, but they'll be flattered that you ask them. And if they think about it a little bit, they might come to articulate some ideas that then you could take and say, huh, okay, I could try that. I could do that. So it's really about personalizing how we show that we care and how we show that we're really capable.
A lot of what we've talked about today speaks to a woman's confidence. And, you know, we could use the status, we could use the imposter syndrome, we could use a lot of these words that we've talked about, but a lot of women still lack the confidence to be able to find those different qualities in themselves. So what would you tell the woman who's listening to this and is thinking to themselves, I wish I could do that. That sounds amazing. If I could only do that and follow her lead, how would you tell people that lack the confidence to move into that direction, to build themselves up? How do they start with that?
Yeah, we have to start where we are and we have to practice. So it's just about moving ourselves in a positive direction. I think two things can be really helpful. The first one is sometimes what we really need is a cheerleader. I talk a lot in the book about being mentored throughout our lifetime and that there's different kinds of mentorship we need. And for a lot of people, they're really good at seeking out yes people, people who will tell them they're doing the right thing. And sometimes if that's all you have, that can be bad. You also need people who are going to critique you and push you. But for people who really lack confidence, those cheerleaders might be the most important mentors they have. Someone who can be that storytelling in their head to say, you absolutely can do this. Let's break this down. Like, let's look at what you've achieved. Let's talk about it. So that would be one thing, is seek out people who do build your confidence and know who to call when you're in a low confidence moment and say, I need a pep talk here. And if your friend or someone you respected called you and said, I need a pep talk, you would be like, I'm on it, right? Let's go. Right. Here we go. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you all the ways you're amazing. Second thing is, I think it's good to put yourself in a situation to be the expert or the mentor or the advice giver. I often find that I often go through my day thinking, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, like I'm 50, I'm still trying to figure it out, et cetera. But then I'll be in a situation where I have to give advice to somebody who's at an earlier stage of life or career than I am. Maybe it's one of my kids. Maybe it's a woman who's called me for help with something like this. And as I'm giving the advice, it occurs to me as you say the words, I do know what I'm talking about. I actually can help. I have advice to give. Like, I've done a lot of this stuff. I know what I'm doing much more. So look for opportunities to be the advice giver, because it will build your confidence. Because when you hear yourself say the things like, here's how you do this, it helps your brain recognize, I actually know what I'm doing.
Yeah. 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 That's good. And I know you've got some examples in the book about, people who are in lower level positions that still have a high status because they're looking for ways to be helpful to other people. And that's another way to gain confidence is your, I think there was an example of a lower level professional who made a PowerPoint and didn't think anything big about it, but then she established herself as this person who knew how to do a PowerPoint, and people kept going to her over and over again. So I would think that that would help build someone's confidence as well once they were asked over and over again to perform some duty or help in some way.
That's right. So, and for women, we definitely don't want to get stuck in the situation where we're stuck in doing the office housework. And there's been great books written about that, because people do ask women for more favors. They often give them the non-promotable work that someone has to do, but doesn't advance your career. And so we have to be careful to look for ways where we can be of service. And the story in the book where the woman was very junior and she knew she needed to be helpful, and people asked her to do these PowerPoints, which weren't in her job. So she said yes once. But then she recognized that she also had a real capability there, that she was, because she had a good business acumen, she wasn't just good at making the charts and graphs. She was actually a good storyteller. And the charts and graphs were just a way to tell a story. So what she was good at figuring out is, how do I make a compelling presentation? And the PowerPoint is just the tools to do that. But when people saw that she was a good storyteller and she was also willing to do the charts and graphs, then she became uniquely valuable. Like, I can give you this high level story I want to tell, and you can go into your office and work on unfolding the story through the charts and graphs. And so it was an opportunity. So I always say, start with anything, try it once. You do not want to let yourself be taken advantage of, but starting to be of service is a good way to see if there's any value there. So one thing that happened to me when I started graduate school, so I'd worked as a consultant for a while, then I decided I'm going to be a psychologist. So I go to graduate school. And when you start, you know, they admit you and they basically tell you, you know nothing, and we are going to teach you all the things you need to know. But just reminder, you know nothing. Okay. You are completely useless. So you feel very low, and you're like, yeah, I don't get any of this. And when I was going to graduate school, it was in the late 90s. And everything was done much more on paper still than it is today. And when we would do research papers and we would submit them, we would submit physical papers. Remember when you'd have to print out your term paper kind of thing, like on the printer? Okay. Mm-hmm. You don't email it. So we would have to print them out. And they had to be formatted in a very specific way according to these standards of our field. And the standards came in a book that was like a phone book. It was thick. And then they would update it every couple of years and change the standards just to make it impossible to follow the rules. And because everything took so long back then, you would have to mail in copies of your paper. And then people would review them and say if they accepted them or not. But then if you didn't format them correctly, they would mail them back to you and say, you didn't do a good job, you have to start over, which means you could lose weeks because you didn't have your heading in the right spot. Now, putting your heading in the right spot was by no means a high-level task. But because the rules, there were a lot of rules, a lot of people didn't know, they didn't take the time to just memorize the rules. So I get to school and I learn that there's this book of rules. And of course, whose responsibility is it to follow all the rules? The lowest status ranking person on the team, which is me. So I had to learn these rules. And I naturally, because I'm good at memorizing stuff, I've always been a good memorizer. I just memorized all the rules. I almost couldn't help myself as I was going through it. I just naturally then knew them all in my head. And I didn't set out to intend to do it, but once I had the rules memorized, when people would be in like just in conversations talking about these formatting rules, I was able to speak up and say, here's the answer. And they would look at me like, how do you know the answer? I said, because I'm just going to tell you, like I read it. It's like in chapter 7. And they went, okay. And then they started to trust. Allison knows all the rules. So after a while, it actually became a reason that people with much higher status and seniority would come to me and talk to me, because people would say, just go ask Allison, she'll tell you what to do. And this was not a high level task. And I could not survive my whole career. If that was all I was good at, was memorizing this book, I would have never survived, right? But it was a way in which when I was a young person and I didn't know everything, I could still think of like a little niche to be of service, like this space over here. So I do tell people, no matter where you are in your career, if you can find a little nook that hasn't really, no one's paying attention to, and you can invest and learn about that, then you can add some value to people. And that will be the beginning of a relationship, Will that be the only value you need to add over the course of that relationship? No. But once they see you as valuable just in a certain way, your foot is in the door, and then they trust you. And then that's the beginning of getting them to give you more work and be able to prove you can do even higher level things. And so I always say to people, like, start with where you are. You don't have to be able to do everything, and find a way to offer something. And then over time, it will build your confidence. Like, when people would come to me, even though the thing they were asking was so, again, it was just a list of rules. It wasn't high level, you know, cognitive thinking. It did build my confidence. Like, I know something, I can help. And then you start to feel more confident in these other ways as well. And so I see a lot of people who are early in their careers feeling like they have nothing to offer. And then I see this other group of people who are no more talented who say, like, I'm going to offer something, just like this woman who did on the PowerPoint. I'm going to figure out something that you like about me that I can serve you. And that's going to be the springboard for me being able to do more and more and more.
Yeah. That's good. I think you're right. I think very often people in those positions, they flounder around. They don't know how to be of service, and they're not using the things they are good at that they can capitalize, because they marginalize that, right? They don't think it's beneficial enough.
That's right. And you don't have to be the world's greatest at something. You just need to be giving somebody something they don't know at that moment. I mean, as professors, we always joke, like, you only need to be 5 minutes ahead of your students. Like, you don't have to know everything. You just need to know more than they do, which is not hard, because they don't care about any of this. So they don't know. So that's the mentality. You have to know more. Like, I joke, like, you know, I have my, everyone most probably have their phone not far away. I always say, like, when I have a problem with technology, I don't even try to figure it out anymore. I just hand my phone to one of my teenagers and I'm like, can you just fix this?
Yep.
And they're like, okay. Now, they're not like tech wizards. They're just, but they're better than me.
They're 5 minutes ahead.
They're 5 minutes ahead. And it's like, that's all you need to be. So I'd say, like, figure out where you're 5 minutes ahead of everyone else around you and start offering that as service. Like, can I help you? Or here, I know how to do that, or whatever it is. And it also does build your confidence, like, to be able to offer to somebody that you think is so much more senior, advanced, established than you, to say, oh, I could actually add value to you. That's also another way in which our confidence builds over time.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Yeah.
And I think there's a word that we used with one of our past guests in the last week that we recorded with. And in her CEO position, she brought in the idea of collaborating with each other. And that had been a word and an action that had not been used in their workplace before, not at great lengths anyway. And I think this is another example of being able to collaborate with those you work with in a way that you can build respect and you can make yourself known for being great at the PowerPoint or having memorized the directions. You know, with the examples you gave, I think that is a great way to build that collaborative atmosphere among your coworkers.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Because you're being of service, right?
Yes.
And collaboration, right, is giving and taking, but it starts with taking's easy, right? We can always figure out more ways to take. It's the figuring out the strategic giving that is hard, because it has to be, when I say strategic giving, it also has to be something that you find joy in, or that it's easy enough for you that you can do it pretty quickly.
Right.
If it's such a lift, so heavy, it will feel, you'll feel miserable every time you have to do it, and it'll take up too much of your day. So that's the strategy part, is figuring out the way. Like, for me, when I was doing the rules, that wouldn't have worked if it was taking me like weeks to memorize that stuff. That would have been a huge waste of my time. The only reason it worked was because for me, it was pretty easy to naturally remember the things. That's what we have to look for. That's the strategy piece. Like, what's the easy give? And I'm always about the easiest lift. Like, what is the easiest way I can make the biggest difference in your life?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with it being easy for the giver. The real measure of impact is the effect it has on the person that's receiving. And I think that's like kind of the strategy piece coming into play.
Yeah. That's great. Allison, you at Ladies Who Launch, you gave us a challenge. You said you gave us the 10-10-10 challenge. And I would love for our listeners to be challenged in the same way you challenged us in the audience.
Okay.
And so meet 10 people, make 10 small deposits, and then ask 10 people to pick up the mic. Can you go through that with our listeners and let's challenge them?
Absolutely. Let's do it. So I'll take a step back to where those three things come from.
Okay.
In order for us to build our status, we need to do two things. We need to be able to talk about ourselves, talk about our credentials, talk about our contributions, talk about our, how much we care. But the other way that our status gets built is it gets built by other people who talk about us, often when we're not even in the room. And this happens so many times, right? You, in fact, how we all got connected to do this podcast, right, was through also an introduction of somebody who was at Ladies Who On, who told me you had this podcast and said, hey, you guys might be a good fit. So when that introduction happens, that's a person who's building the status of everybody saying, hey, like, you're great, you're great. So we want more people to be out there while we're in here doing our work. We want more people being out there talking about how great we are because they'll be building our status for us. And isn't that nice? We don't even have to say anything about our credentials or how much we care. Other people are telling everybody for us. So in order for us to get more of that, there's three things we need to do. And that's where the challenge comes in. The first thing we need to do is just get comfortable meeting more people. Because rule number one is people cannot talk you up if they do not know you exist. So when we bring more people into our lives, we increase the number of people who have the potential to talk us up. Now, not all of them will, and many people stay in our lives for just minutes, but meeting more people. And I tell some stories in the book about how some people have been really impactful for my career and have really been great at talking me up were not people I met in career settings at all. In fact, this impactful person I talk about in the book, I met her in an airport bar. So the people who might be great gifts to your life could be anywhere. So meeting more people. So that's the first part of the challenge is meet 10 people. I don't care. They don't have to become 10 best friends, but just practice that muscle of talking to people, meeting people. And I say this as an introvert, so I'm not a person who really loves talking to strangers, but it helps. Mm-hmm. Second thing is, once someone knows you exist, they first have to respect you themselves. Otherwise, they're never going to say anything nice about you when you're not around. So that's where these easy gifts come in. And I call those small deposits. It's something easy for you to do, but it has a lot of value for somebody else. Okay. And looking for those things. So thinking about your favorite small deposits, I say introductions are always a great one that almost everybody can do. Literally everybody. Mm-hmm. Because when I introduce you to someone that can help you, I'm both kind and caring because I made the introduction, but it also shows me as capable. I know people that have value. And my network is useful to you. So that's an example of a small deposit. It's one of my favorite ones to do. Mm-hmm. It's something quick and easy I can do that allows you to see, oh, I have value, right? So making 10 of those. And I just go through the world and listen to people and I hear their stories, whether I know them or I'm meeting them for the first time and they tell me about their life. I just think, do I know anything that could help? It could be anything. It could be like, here's a book I think you would enjoy reading based on what you just told me your new challenges are at work. Or here's the brilliant home organizer I met who is done wonders for my closets. You know, when you tell me about the fact that you're like so stressed, like picking up after your kids or whatever it is, what can I offer to you? Or a lot of times I offer small amounts of time for me that are not taking time away from real deep work that I could be doing, but are time that I could offer to help people. So I do, I've taught negotiation for over 20 years. Lots of people want negotiation advice when they need to build their confidence going into a big negotiation and they want my help. And I think if I sat there and did that all day long, I wouldn't be able to do my work. Mm-hmm. But how could I make a small deposit? And a small deposit is I can talk to you, like I can give you 15 minutes like negotiation speed advice. And I'm going to schedule it at a time when I otherwise couldn't be doing much else. Like if I know I'm going to be at the airport, if I know I'm going to be like in my car and I can't do too much else. And so I'm strategic about putting those things in places where they're pretty easy for me to do, but they can have a big impact. And so that's a small deposit. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is this idea of encouraging people to talk about us once they know us and then they respect us. Step three is, we have to give them a little nudge to talk about us. They may not be doing it. not because they're not willing to do it, because they're not thinking about us. And so it's never really occurred to them that this is important to us. They just don't know. Mm-hmm. So, but if we tell them it's important, they're going to say, oh, okay, I'm happy to do it, right? Mm-hmm. So giving people a nudge to say, hey, you know what could be really helpful to me is if you would tell whatever audience that you care about some of the things I'm doing, and that would really help, you know, my impact and my respect with that person. I know they really respect you. And I gave some examples of how I've done it, but I've gotten some nice examples from strangers who have read the book and who have tried this. Like a woman said to me, wrote to me and said, my boss got to go to like a annual meeting that I was not senior enough to attend. But a lot of the other people who were there, fellow senior people, are people that I really need to value me to be able to do my work well. So I told my boss, I asked my boss if when he was at the meeting, would he make sure to find these couple of people and make sure to drop it in a casual way, how great I was and what a good job I was doing. And she then sent me the text that her boss sent her because the boss was very happy to do it. Of course, I'll do that for you. And went around and found the people and talked her up. And then he texted her like looking for his flowers. Like, look, I did it. I did a good job. I talked you up. So that's what I mean by giving someone a nudge, is telling them like this would be really impactful. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if it were reversed, if someone comes to you and says, hey, I know you value me. If you could spread that to this audience, would you do it? You're super grateful. You're like, of course I would do it. Mm-hmm. You're amazing. Why wouldn't I tell people how amazing you are? But you might not have been thinking about that at that moment. So that's what I mean about giving them that nudge. So asking 10 people to talk you up, which at the beginning feels kind of scary, but I say just try it once. If you're petrified, try it once. I really am confident based on my own experience and the people I've coached is what you'll find is that person's really happy to do it. And maybe even if they forget and don't do it, that's not even the important part. The part is you ask them and they're not mad. They're like relieved that you told them with clarity what you want, and it'll build your confidence to maybe do it 9 more times.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I love it. Yeah.
So I don't know if you were sitting here thinking the same thing I was thinking, but I am thinking about the podcast, Allison. When we talk about those 3 challenges, it really defines when we set out on this journey of the podcast, you know, just 2 girls who were friends and we're working in different brokerages and we had a commonality between us. Well, now over the 2.5 years we've been doing this, it's about the people we meet and the people we've met who could introduce us to other people mm-hmm. they know mm-hmm. and could say something nice about the podcast and or Angie and I, and that lead to yet another interview and another interesting conversation. So this challenge is really perfect for she and I coming into a new year and ways to build the podcast. Mm-hmm. So if we can, you know, sit here in that 5 minutes of you going over those 3 key points and we can think in those terms, then think about all of the people who are listening who can be impacted by that in their lives.
Yeah, totally. And a podcast is such a good example because you have all these people who love you and respect you and value and want to be helpful, but they don't have a podcast. They don't really understand how this works and they have no idea what would be useful. And I found this when I wrote my book, I shop a lot on Amazon. Like, you know, I can get batteries in 2 hours, et cetera. Yeah, you know, it's great.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I never review products. Even if I think the product is great or terrible, I don't have time for that. Like, I'm not a professional reviewer. Right. But when it comes to books for authors, book reviews on Amazon, because Amazon rules the world, turn out to be really important for the mm-hmm. online reach of the book. And the more positive reviews you have, the more likely it appears in an algorithm when people are searching for things that relate to your book. Right. I didn't know any of this till I was an author. And most people who don't write books would have no reason to know this. So as an example, like you, like asking someone to rate your podcast, to tell people about it, to have them subscribe, these are metrics that people would be glad to do, but they don't understand that they're important. Mm-hmm. Just like I had to explain to people, hey, when you put that 5 stars on the book, because you already told me you really liked it, it's not a hard ask because you wrote to me and you said, I loved your book. And then I would say, if you would say the same thing, but to Amazon, mm-hmm. that would really help me. Everyone is like happy to do it. Had no idea this was important. And it's the same kind of thing as I normally wait until I know I have a fan. And then I say, hey, here's a small thing that you could do that has a huge impact to me. And again, they're relieved. They're like, oh, thanks for telling me. I just didn't know. So I think it's a really good example of we're in these unique spaces, but everyone thinks that everyone else understands what's most helpful and they don't know what's most helpful. But as soon as you tell them, you're like, oh, that makes sense. Yes, I can see why that's helpful. Yes, I will get on that right away because it's so easy. Like it's easy to subscribe to a podcast, to rate it, to tell somebody, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's easy to review your book. So now we need to do that.
I'm writing that.
We got that on our to-do list, Allison. We're going to get that done. We don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I have a couple of quick questions.
Okay.
One, has there been anything that really surprised you as a result of the book? Any comments that you've heard, people that have said something that you thought, oh, I'm so glad I did this book because I didn't know XYZ.
A couple of things. One is I get so many questions about people who are introverted. So I do think so many people who feel like they can't do this. And when I tell them I'm actually an introvert as well, that's been a nice kind of conversation that's happened. I didn't really talk about that in the book. I think I would have had I known how many people feel like they struggle with building status as an introvert. That's one thing. And the another thing that has surprised me is how much convincing I've had to do about the idea that being likable is really a superpower. I think because so many women have gotten so much feedback on their likability over time that they're just tired of it. And they feel like, I'm tired of being told what to do. I'm tired of being told I'm not likable when I'm perfectly likable. Forget it. I've just given up on the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I've had to do a lot of coaching to say, you can be annoyed at that feedback, but let's not let the annoyance distract you from the strategy and the truth, which is that being well-liked by people is an evidence-based, huge source of advantage, right? We see this in all the science, right? When people like you, they're more likely to say yes to you. You're much more influential. They want to be around you. We're the same way. Do you like being around people you don't like? No. Do you like saying yes to people you don't like? No. So that's another one that did surprise me a bit because I think I was so much in the science of likability that a lot of that biased feedback that women get about likability, it kind of just rolled off me. But I realized for so many women, they've like just felt drenched in it and felt really frustrated. So I've had to do a little more work on that piece to kind of get people back and be like, you didn't deserve that thing that happened to you. But you are a very giving, warm person. And let's not lose sight of that because when you show that to people, it will reap a lot of benefits for you. And that I think I'm convincing once I get to tell my whole story, but it's amazing to me. It surprised me a bit how much there was just so many women who felt like I'm done with likable and I'm trying to bring it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. All right. My last question is just random,
okay.
But you can get this book. You can buy the book, obviously hardback, paperback, whatever, but you can also listen to it online. And I've done both. And I'm just curious, you do your own narrative of the book and how does that get done? Like, do you sit for hours on end and do this or is it done in I've just always been curious about people because I love the fact that you narrate your own book because I always find that I connect with the book better when it's the author who's doing the speaking. But I'm just curious how that process works.
I'm going to give you a slightly longer story than you maybe wanted, but it's the backstory. So I was actually not supposed to do my own audiobook. Oh. So what happened was I wanted to do it, but I was told that a lot of publishers don't like authors to do audiobooks. They prefer to hire a trained actor because the actor is just going to be faster and better because they do this for a living. And so when it came time for the audiobook, I was not asked if I want to do it. My publisher simply said, you know, we're going to have somebody record it. And I said, what about me? And they said, if you would like to audition for your audiobook, we will get you the audition guidelines. And then I said, I'm not auditioning to read a book I wrote. If that's how you feel about it, no. And I was really mad. And I told my agent I was really mad. And I just like went off mad. And then I was talking to another author that I really respect, is Annie Duke, who is a former professional poker player. Now she's a cognitive science professor, and she's written several books on risk and decision-making. We were talking, and I respect her a lot, and I was telling her what had happened, and she said, "Allison, this is a hill to die on." She says, "You write that publisher back and you tell them that you are reading this book for the exact reasons you say, which is people really like it, especially in a nonfiction book where the person is the thought leader. They like to hear it from the person because it feels like a masterclass, right?" Mm-hmm. And I don't listen to, I read more than I listen. So this was kind of news to me. So I literally wrote an email that said, "Annie Duke has said, this is a hill to die on. Like, I need to read this book." That's like my email. And which they write back, "Okay, fine." So I went from, "You have to audition," to, "Okay, fine. All right." So the way it happens is then they have a producer, and I fly to New York, and they have a studio that you go to. It's like a rented studio, and you sit in like a locked little box with the producer in the next room, and they are listening to you. And then the producer jumps in and helps you with, "You've slurred a word, you've mispronounced something. Wait, we don't know how to pronounce this person's name because no one's ever said it." So they look it up for you. We talk about how to translate charts and graphs into an audiobook. So you're having to like actually do a little problem solving as you're reading, because not everything in writing always translates well to speaking. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about that. And you do it. And so, but here's my thing. They booked 3 days. I finished in under two. And the producer was like, "You're a pro at this. You're so good." And every time someone compliments me on the audiobook, I almost want to like be like, "Here's my editor's email address. If you could write to her and say, look, she knew what she was doing. She was good at this." So that's how it came to be. And every time someone compliments me, I feel like tremendous joy, because I have known like how not wanted I was in this whole book. But that's how it happened.
Great story.
Yeah.
Great. I love that. Well, thank you, Allison. We appreciate your time, your humor, and your narrative on this great book. We hope that, you know, our little podcast can help you sell 100 more, or 1,000 more, 10,000 more.
Thank you for sharing your audience with me. I could talk to you guys all day. You're amazing.
Yeah, this has been great. And we want to thank you for tuning in and listening to us. And we hope that you enjoy this episode and share it with a friend and buy the book.
Buy the book. Like a little badass. Who doesn't want to read something like that? Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
Find today's full video by searching the Simply Authentic Podcast on YouTube. Hit subscribe, and there you will find full videos of every episode.